Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the voice of goalkeeping, Mr. Richard Lee. For the third successive week, we are without Joe Forrester, but just like the career of a journeyman, John Burridge, we shall plough on regardless. Now, this week's show was recorded on location at Watford, so while sound isn't quite as crisp as it usually would be straight from the studio, hopefully you can still sit back, relax, and enjoy the tales as told by this week's goalkeeper guest. Some really good stuff from a player, a coach, or simply a goalkeeping fan's perspective. It's the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon. This week's guest is a man who enjoyed more than 20 years in the game as a goalkeeper with Brentford, Falkirk, Fulham, West Ham, and a whole host of others. He's since gone on to become an award-winning goalkeeper coach, working alongside the likes of Hugo Lloris, Shea Given, John Ruddy, and more recently Ben Foster at Watford. He can also boast the distinction of having won a major European trophy with Tottenham Hotspur. Tony Parks, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Evening.
I'm going to start this right from the very beginning because we must have done 14 or 15 of these podcasts now and we've never asked one guest how they came to be a goalkeeper. What was it that made you decide to be a goalkeeper?
I know exactly the time it was. I was 8 years of age. I was at school and a flyer, I guess it was you would call it, went round the school and a guy was setting up a football team, and he was having trials at Hackney Marshes at the time, was where I'm from, in East London. Hackney Marshes was at the time a real hotbed for a number of years of producing top flight footballers prior to me being old enough to join the ranks. And we went along to Hackney Marshes after school, 4 o'clock, and the guy had two jumpers at each end laid out. Asked the players just to go and stand in a position they wouldn't mind playing in. And for some reason, I have no clue why, I just went and stood in goal. And everyone tells me that they kind of always wanted to be a right back or a centre half or a centre forward or a whatever position it was, and they kind of gradually worked their way back. But in goal, for me, from day one, never changed. I loved it from the moment I played in goal.
Never looked back. So literally, jumpers for goalposts.
Yes, it was, yeah. It was, yeah. It was fantastic. I mean, it was a fantastic area. I think, you know, the site now is where the Olympic site was built. There was just hundreds and hundreds of pitches back in the day. And like I say, it was a real hotbed and that was where my career started.
So if we fast forward then to making the break at Spurs, the extraordinary thing I've taken from doing the research on you and your career, your debut, 17 years old.
Yeah, Cup Winners' Cup, I think it was away in... it was one of the Irish teams. I came on for Ray Clements. I think we'd won the first leg quite comfortably and the manager gave me my debut in the Cup Winners' Cup, and then the following season, I think I made my league debut away at West Ham. I had a meteoric rise as a young kid and I had some talent, but I never had the brains to cope with being a professional footballer. And that cost me really long term, I suppose. I look back on my playing career and it's kind of petered out and misfired, and that was all down to me not being prepared enough or professional enough or willing to give enough as a player.
Is that one of the main reasons you then went into coaching? The fact that it didn't maybe have the highlights you were expecting there to be in your career?
Yeah, I think, well, when you join a club, like I went to Tottenham when I was 12 years of age and I worked really hard as a young kid. I did all the things that everyone does, the sacrifices that you make, and came through the ranks and all the way through and into the first team. And I think the biggest problem that I had was when I got in the first team, I had a modicum of success quite early on at the age of 21. I'm in a team that's winning the UEFA Cup. And people think that I only came on as a sub for the penalty shootout, but I played 30 games that year and I was keeping England international Ray Clements out of the team. He was fit, he was on the bench. And that was, you know, I thought that's what was going to happen every year for me. I thought that's how football worked at that point. And I think, obviously, now with hindsight, you know that once you reach the top, you have to work twice as hard to stay there. And I didn't have the brains to deal with that. So I had some talent, and that took me so far. And then once I broke into the coaching, I used all of that negative stuff, I guess, to say I'm not going to make the same mistakes as a coach.
Mm. It's unthinkable, isn't it, now for that to happen? I mean, that was top flight football that you were playing as a teenager.
Yeah.
For a manager now in the Premier League or any top league, top five, shall we say, to throw a 17-year-old goalkeeper in at the deep end, it just wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I think we were very lucky at Tottenham as young players growing up. We had a manager in Keith Birkinshaw who was a firm believer in youth development. Probably a little bit before his time. I think he, maybe you, Richard, know him from his days at Watford. I don't know if you ever came across Keith Birkinshaw when he came to Watford. And
that's right.
He was he was every single game, every Saturday morning, watching youth team players. Mm. School holidays, we were integrated into first team training sessions. He always wanted to see how we were developing and could we cope. And if he felt we were ready, we got opportunity. And I'm not sure that I would, you know, Hugo Lloris is France's number one and their captain. Would I keep him out of the team now if he was fit? Probably not. But Keith gave me the opportunity to keep England's number one goalkeeper out of the team. And I think that was the confidence that he gave young players. So, yeah, you're right. It probably would be unheard of, but we were lucky in that we had a manager that believed in youth.
Well, Lloris is an interesting case, right? As is Donnarumma at AC Milan, who started early. Lloris started as a teenager at Nice. Is there an argument here that gaining your experience in proper, actual football makes so much more of a difference than playing, I don't know, in a youth team, in a reserve team, or playing in non-league, for example?
Well, I think that the game is based not only for goalkeepers, but for young players in general. The game is absolutely about opportunity. So young English talent has less opportunity in this country because of the influx of top, top foreign players. And so all of the best French players come to England and to Spanish and the Argentinians, which obviously opens up a massive gap in Ligue 1 and the like for youngsters to play. So I came across Hugo when I was a national coach for the English FA playing against France, and watched his career kind of develop all the way through from, you know, under 16s to under 18s, 19 European Championships, under 21s into their first team. But he then gets a break in the first team in Nice and quickly gets a move to Lyon. And he's a young man that by the time he comes to Tottenham at the age of 24, 26, he's amassed a massive amount of experience in Champions League, international football. Yeah. And it's the game is the best teacher. You know, you're now coaching someone that's learning on the job, and you can help him develop where he's making his mistakes, but he's making those mistakes actually in games, so it's happening before his eyes. How does he put that right the next time he sees that situation?
I want to talk to you a bit about Lloris, because I know we've had this conversation previously where I know you put your neck on the line to some extent to bring Lloris to Tottenham, because it wasn't a unanimous decision at the time, if I remember rightly. And it's quite rare, from my experience, for a goalkeeper coach to have that much influence and maybe be that brave to say to a manager, to a head of recruitment, directors, whoever it was you had to speak to at the time, this is the guy you need to go for.
It's a really interesting story, because at the time at Tottenham, we had a wealth of top talent as goalkeepers. We had Brad Friedel, Carlo Cudicini and Aurelio Gomez. All three goalkeepers that I rate extremely highly. It was felt that we needed a long-term replacement for Brad. And we were sat on a train travelling from Baltimore to New York in a pre-season. And the club secretary asked myself and the manager at the time, Andre Villas-Boas, to come and sit with the chairman and have a chat with him. And we were told that we were in the market for a new goalkeeper. What was our thoughts? I knew that the manager preferred a certain goalkeeper. And the chairman asked me my thoughts on that goalkeeper, and my view was that Lloris was a better option. I'm a real firm believer in that a goalkeeper should be recruited to keep the ball out the net. not to be a passing quarterback type goalkeeper. So the criteria for me was all about decision making. All goalkeepers at that level can make great saves. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem. That's a prerequisite as far as I'm concerned. But it's the add-ons, it's the decision making, the speed of thought, dealing with the ball in behind back fours, which Lloris was outstanding at. It, compared to the goalkeeper that the manager wanted, was from a different type of football. He played deep in his goal, but we wanted to play a high line. I was brought to the club initially, Harry Redknapp was the manager, but it was Daniel Levy that brought me to the club and gave me the contract and kind of trusted me to run a goalkeeping department. And I like to think I put a quite decent one together. And he and the manager trusted my judgment. And I don't understand why people that haven't played in goal don't trust people that have played in goal. I genuinely, I don't. Because it's very easy to criticise, which is probably the only time that goalkeepers get spoken to by outfield coaches, managers, is when things have gone wrong. And knowing the pitfalls of playing in goal, like yourself, you know how easy it is to be brilliant or mm-hmm. poor on any given day.
Yeah,
split second.
The Lloris one fascinates me, actually. Matt and myself, we had to put a piece together recently for one of the major newspapers on Lloris and De Gea. And it was interesting because the reputation that Lloris seems to have recently, the odd person might call him a bit rash from time to time. But the thing that we found out when you compared the two goalkeepers was that Lloris was coming for about five times as many crosses, about seven times as many through balls as De Gea. Mm. And in terms of effectiveness, I think he's second this season behind Alisson, if you're to believe the stats, whereas De Gea is about ninth.
Yeah.
But of course, the general public, the majority of whom will be outfield players, of course, just the law of averages, would prefer De Gea over Lloris.
And I think that boils down to my point. If you've never played in goal, you see goalkeepers only in the brilliant save department. What a great save. What a brilliant save. Let's show a replay of that. You don't show a great decision for Lloris to come out and sweep up behind a back four.
And also, I suppose, given the fact that he's coming for so many through balls, I mean, it was incredible to see the amount that he comes for. Of course, you're going to make more mistakes.
He starts off the front foot. And he's happy to come and put himself on offer. And if I throw that back way back to the 80s when Bruce Grobbelaar took over from Ray Clements at Liverpool, and you'd wake up to Monday morning headlines in the newspapers of a clown, the clown prince, Grobbelaar messes up again. Bruce Grobbelaar changed the face of goalkeeping, in my opinion, was one of the great goalkeepers of all time. Changed the face of goalkeeping from a goalkeeper that was reactive on his line and making saves to a proactive goalkeeper that would come and work off of his line. He was the first goalkeeper I saw come and take a cross on 18 yards. And if he's going to come and do that 10 times a game, he's going to make some mistakes. Because there's only one guarantee when the game kicks off that all of the 22 players and the officials are going to make some mistakes. Unfortunately for a goalkeeper, the mistakes are kind of highlighted because it's all they've got behind is a net. So, you know, it's a difficult one.
And it's funny, isn't it, on Lloris, because that's what's been highlighted this season. There was the mistake in the World Cup final, but they won, so it was essentially forgotten, swept under the carpet. But there's been a couple of incidents in the Champions League this season. Gazzaniga has played the last two games in the Cup. No doubt Lloris will come back in for the Premier League games. But what's your take on A, Lloris's season, and B, the criticism that he's received?
Listen, I think that I think probably the off-field problem that he had with the with the drink driving offence has affected him more than what people would know. I know him personally. I was probably as surprised as anyone that Hugo Lloris would be arrested for drinking and driving and charged. And I think that embarrassment added to all of the furore of winning a World Cup. None of us know that kind of feeling. I know the feeling of winning a trophy, but to win the World Cup as captain of your country and all of those add-ons have probably kind of knocked the edge off of his form a little bit this season. I've heard people say that his handling's not been so good. But I think that the problems that he had this season are probably down to mental issues in terms of concentration and refocusing after some real highs of winning the World Cup and then real lows of the problems off the pitch. And I think in the last few weeks, he almost looks like he's coming back to the Hugo that people know.
Another goalkeeper you've worked with, John Ruddy. You were with him at Norwich. Quite an interesting story for him this season. I know he's come out publicly and spoken about his situation being behind Rui Patricio, having been the number one choice when Wolves came up last season. What do you think he can do to either reclaim that number one spot, if possible, or does he need to look elsewhere to be a number one again?
I would probably... I would say the only way that John is going to find his way back as regular number one at Wolves at the moment is if the manager were to change, and I can't see that happening. He's, you know, he's getting lots of plaudits and pats on the back for the way that his teams play. I know Rui Patricio as a goalkeeper very well. You know, as part of your job is to do that recruitment process on players like that. And I thought it was a strange signing when they made it. But the manager being Portuguese, knowing him well as a Portuguese experienced goalkeeper, is obviously a good fit for him. And John's probably would, for me, need to get away and reclaim his number one shirt somewhere else. I mean, if you have a look at John's record in the Championship, it's unbelievable for, in terms of playing in teams that have won promotion and won leagues. And he's probably been in a couple of sides that have gone up and stayed in the team that have got relegated either the following season or the season after. So maybe, I don't know, maybe the managers looked at that and thought, is he top draw Premier League quality? Whereas I'm bringing in a top draw international number one. And you would have to say on Wolves' form and their position in the league and Patrizio's form, that it was a decision that was probably well made by the manager. So for me, John, great lad, really, really top trainer, a fantastic lad to work with, would probably need to leave Wolves if he wants to be a regular starter for somebody.
Touching on those two, so Hugo Lloris and John Redding, there's loads of other examples of goalkeepers you've worked with, but those two, good example, they're very different goalkeepers, completely different goalkeepers. As a goalkeeper coach, and we get a load of goalkeeper coaches that listen to this podcast, how would you deal with those two individuals, bearing in mind that I'm assuming it can't be one size fits all? It must be a case of adapting to those goalkeepers?
Yeah, I always find it really strange when I see goalkeeping coaches working. So, for instance, if you go and watch a game, I think you'll see a good goalkeeping coach who will let his goalkeepers, one, two and three that are on the pitch warming up, and he'll be dictated to by the goalkeeper as to what the goalkeeper needs to get him to the start line and the referee blowing his whistle to start that game. I always find it really strange when I watch goalkeeping coaches go out and almost put on a mini training session for all of the three goalkeepers to do exactly the same. So John Ruddy was never going to be someone that would be showing bursts of speed to deal with balls in behind the back four, whereas Hugo was. So you would try to, I would genuinely try to work training sessions that gave them both something from each other's game. So the things that John was good at, we would do elements of that, and the things that also that worked with Frieda, who was very similar to John Ruddy, who liked to play deeper in his goal. But I found that once Hugo came in and we started to do more work with stuff, dealing with balls in behind back fours and stuff like that, Brad took it on board, and although didn't take it all the way and become over the top excessive with it, when he needed to, he made better decisions based on better starting positions. And so I think you have to get into the mind of the goalkeeper. Goalkeeping coaching is all about, for me, it's all about the psyche of the goalkeeper. It's no good me coming to say to Richard Lee, you're doing this today. I lose you from day one. I have to find out what I can give you. I have to know what you're good at. I have to know your strengths, and we work on them. And then we gain confidence, and then we talk, and then I say, what about this, and could we try that, and would you be interested in this? And if I do stuff, you have to be brave enough to say to me, that doesn't work for me, and we leave that out of your training program. So I think it's a real balancing act, but you're right, it is not one size fits all, and I think you have to be really careful as a goalkeeping coach and make sure that you are in the heads of the goalkeepers. Not overly friendly, you can't be best friends, but you certainly have to be professionally friendly and adapt to the goalkeepers that you work with.
So you mentioned psyche and mindset there. If you're someone like John Ruddy now, and you are a number two, you were a number two yourself, like you said, up against a giant of goalkeeping in Ray Clemens, Is it something that can spur you on to think I can get to that level? Or is it disheartening to think I've got no chance here?
Yeah, I would have thought from John's point of view, John would be very downbeat about his position at Wolves. Having helped that club regain its status in the Premier League, I would have thought he probably felt that he would have deserved a chance to show the manager that he was good enough. And I would say for John would find it, he would be downbeat, but not unprofessional. And I think you always have to make sure that you're ready to start the next game. And the difference being today is he's on the bench. And if he has to come on. Back in the day, I would sit in the stand or I wouldn't travel to an away game because there was no need, because there wasn't a sub-goalkeeper in those days. So I think the mindset is slightly different, that John has to be prepared to play every week. And so that disappointment will be greater as the weeks go by and he doesn't play.
So Tony, obviously, without blowing smoke, one of the best known goalkeeper coaches in the country. You know, it seems like there's an elite band that people seem to talk about, yourself, the likes of Eric Steele and a couple of other names that come up quite regularly. You've seen goalkeeping change beyond recognition from when you were playing yourself to where goalkeeping is now. And it seems to be going even further. Do you think that the understanding of goalkeeping is improving? And where do you think goalkeeping is going? Does it concern you at all that, I mean, distribution now, it seems like it's the in thing. It's what everybody talks about. Obviously, there's positive to that, but is there also a danger to that?
I think there's a huge danger to it. Listen, I think, you know, everywhere you go, you listen to young English coaches. First of all, it was Mourinho. Now it's Guardiola. Everyone wants to go and watch a Guardiola work. And they have to have goalkeepers that can play football. And I find it really strange that an outfield coach, I might as well just pick my best midfield. I might as well put Kevin De Bruyne in goal if that's the case. And might as well put Will Hughes in goal at Watford if that's the case. Because at the end of the day, the goalkeeper's job is to keep the ball out of the net. And that's what I'm looking for. Whereas the conflict comes when the outfield coach, on a Monday morning, in an academy environment, you'll have under-9s, under-10s, under-16s coaches saying to the goalkeeping coach, yeah, he wasn't very good with a back pass on. So is there a reason for that? Well, he just didn't kick it very well. Can you tell me why? Can I have a look? Can you see? Can you show? So if I touch on Lloris, his weakest part of his game is as a footballer. Mm-hmm. He's right foot non-existent, left foot adequate at best, how I see it. What Pochettino and his coaching staff do is work an awful lot on what options Hugo will have once he receives a back pass. And what I see a lot of is still the old school, give it to the goalkeeper as a last resort, and then the goalkeeper just sees numbers running away from him. Or people almost faking that they want to play out from the back without really showing the best angle, good depth, good body position to say, give me the ball, which leaves the goalkeeper in a pretty miserable position with overexposed, lots of space around him and only the net behind him. So if you're going to play out from the back, if you want a goalkeeper to be a footballer, he doesn't have to be a great footballer. You just have to make his teammates appreciate the fact that when you pass to him, you have to give him space, time and another angle for him to play and let him make his own decision. So the coach will also then insist. If we think about John Atterberg, when Klopp first took over, he was having all sorts of problems playing out from the back because he was told you have to play out from the back. That's in the Premier League. Where's your decision making? You've taken the decision away from the goalkeeper. Now he's vulnerable because he doesn't want to play short. He wants to go long because he knows it's the right position. But if he plays long, he's getting shouted at from the touchline by the coach. So, you know, we have to let goalkeepers play their game and see the decisions and see the pictures and if they and then improve them in terms of their depth to receive and the like. And I did some work for Xavi Manquissa-Sor up at Man City in terms of some scouting when they signed Edison. And I think Guardiola was preferring at the time, he was preferring Bernd Leno, who he knew from the German league to be a good footballing goalkeeper. And I just thought Edison was, he reminded me again of a Lloris. He was brave off of his line. He was brave physically and he was brave mentally. He was fast across the ground. He struggled with crosses into the box. In Champions League games that I watched, physically he struggled, but he was strong enough to be able to come and deal with that once he got into the system. And he had a wonder of a left foot. So I don't know what the problem was with him playing out from the back. So I did some work for Mancuso Sor up at Man City, who was obviously asking Guardiola, this is the goalie that I think we should be getting. And he enlisted with the help of me and some reports, and they took them back to Guardiola. And they again, a manager listened to the expert advice that his goalkeeping coach had given him. He'd done his homework on both.
Mm.
And I think, you know, the story again, a bit like Lloris, is there for all to see. He's a wonderful goalkeeper who is actually a wonderful footballer. Mm. He's got a wonderful left foot and could probably play in midfield, and did as a 9-year-old kid, played futsal right the way through into his teenage years as an outfield stroke old school rush goalkeeper.
Yeah.
And people don't understand that, you know. Mm. You don't understand that I played in goal all my life, so I only had to learn how to kick it out of my hands and off the floor. But this kid was playing outfield in futsal. Futsal is one of the best games I've ever seen for improving your touch and your quality, your pass and your speed of thought. So he had a really good grounding in how to be a footballer.
Mm.
And you know, it's no coincidence that he's, like, you know, probably could play in their midfield in an FA Cup tie. If they stuck him in midfield, he probably wouldn't look out of place in terms of his passing ability.
Mm.
Do you think that's actually a thing? Because there's been an argument recently, and a lot of people have put tweets out and all the rest of it, saying goalkeepers, Edison, Alisson, they could play in central midfield. Do you think that's actually a thing? They could potentially get away with it?
Well, I think you'd have to be very, very careful with how you played the game, because I don't think they would have the physical, the demands of the game, the anaerobic fitness to get up and down and box to box. Playing in midfield is a tough ask. You know, you've got your short, sharp burst, your long, lung busting.
And your awareness as well.
And your peripheral vision needs to be so great. Whereas in goal, the game is always in front of you. So if you played them, you'd probably have to play them as a sweeper behind two centre-halves so they could always see the game, making sure that your goalkeeper stayed on his line, because if you played one of them two in that position, they'd always want to drop off and play the ball, and there you'd have your problem of a goalkeeper coming too close to your sweeper, as it were. So, I mean, I think that they could play on the training ground. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they could play in a pre-season game. Could they play in the Premier League? Absolutely not. That's why they're playing goal.
I've got a question for you, which is, might be a bit of an awkward question, and I don't know if there's necessarily an answer that you can give, and I'll explain why before I ask the question. But the question's going to be who you would have as your top goalkeeper in the Premier League. The reason I say there might not be an answer is whether there's an argument for goalkeepers suiting certain teams. And to give an example, let's say that David De Gea were to drop into League One, have crosses lumped into the box all day, whether we'd still see the David De Gea that we see today. Similarly, if Edison were playing in a slightly different team that didn't need to play out from the back and he was just lumping at 70 yards all the time, whether we would quite see him in the same light.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think as part of the recruitment, the recruitment of a goalkeeper should be based on how your team plays and how you set up and what your preference is. Edison plays brilliantly at Liverpool because Liverpool play quite deep and wide. Alisson.
Mm-hmm.
They play deep and wide and they spread the game and they play out through the goalkeeper, always using him as the spare man. When I had the conversation with Andre Villas-Boas, when he went in at Chelsea, he had an ageing back four and a goalkeeper that liked to play within his six-yard box in Petr Cech, who is, for me, one of the all-time great goalkeepers, without a doubt.
Mm.
And he wanted that ageing back four to squeeze high.
Mm.
And that's why Chelsea lost a lot of games 1-0. Mm. With teams worked them out, the goalkeeper played deep, the back four played high with not a lot of pace. And if you can get up and around it with some clever play and then just play into the space behind with pace, you can hurt them. And the conversation was, if you want to do that at Tottenham, you need a goalkeeper that is prepared to go from 18-yard line to 25, 30, 35 metres at times to read that through ball. You had a quicker back four at Tottenham, younger, quicker back four. They were happy to play high. And the problem that we was having a little bit at the start was when they wanted to play high and Brad wanted to play a little bit deeper. But as soon as you dropped As soon as you drop Lloris into that position, the back four just grew in confidence. Vertonghen was happy to squeeze. He was happy to walk people in towards the halfway line because he knew he had an insurance policy behind him. So absolutely. And I think the signing of that Liverpool made in Alisson was perfect for the way they want to play. Would he play quite so well in a Man City team that squeezes up? I'm not sure. So yes, I think you do have to recruit depending on how you play. Mm. It's no point if you want to play. I can never understand why Liverpool paid 30 million for Andy Carroll. Mm. 32 million for Benteke. Why? They never play the ball wide and get crosses into the box and knock long balls from the back to the front. They play football.
Yeah.
So why would you as that type of centre forward think that Liverpool were going to change for you? And you know, they've brought a goalkeeper in that absolutely suits their style of play.
Mm. Okay, it's 1983. Anderlecht, UEFA Cup final, second leg, as it was in those days. You drew 1-1 at their place. You're a 21-year-old goalkeeper about to face a penalty shootout in order to win the UEFA Cup final for Spurs. What's going through your mind?
I think by that stage, that had become quite easy. The hard part of that whole game was the day was very long, so we didn't kick off until the evening. So you've got a long, long day, way before the days of staying away in hotels for too long. And so you was at home and you've got plenty of time to think about it. You've got plenty of time to get nervous about it. And then you've got to sit in traffic on your way to the stadium and get more and more nervous. And so I don't remember too many games as a young goalie where I was nervous from the moment I woke up. When we kicked off, the nerves normally go, as you know, but they didn't. The nerves stayed with me for the whole game because I think I actually felt the importance of the game in a stadium that was absolutely packed to the rafters at White Hart Lane with, you know, back in the day, the old stands all standing and crowds swaying to and fro in. And I think the expectation was because we'd got a great performance and a great result away from home that we were just going to roll up and roll over Anderlecht. And they had a team full of top players. Morten Olsen, Enzo Schifo, a 17-year-old who went on to be one of the world best. Jackie Mooner on in goal on the night was fantastic. Frank Arnesen and Verkouteren, they were all top international players. And they were brilliant on the night. And they reversed the fortunes and went one up and we scrambled and scrambled and Mooneron played well and we ended up with a 1-1. And when it went to penalties, it was like almost like, oh, the pressure's off now. Because there is no pressure on you as a goalie to save a penalty. There is no... If a professional footballer from 12 yards strikes the ball properly into a goal that's 48 square feet, he should score.
Right.
But stick 55,000 screaming Tottenham fans in your face and the pressure of the cup final, and the pressure becomes all upon the outfield player because I'm not expected to save any. And if I do, I'm great. So it worked out really well for me on the evening, only because Morten Olsen, who was Danish captain at the time, went on to lift the European Championships with Denmark. He missed the first penalty, which I saved, and then the penalties went even Stevens all the way through, and then Mooneron saved what would have won it for us from Danny Thomas. Mm-hmm. That left them with one penalty, and that then was we then had Arne Gudjonsson, who was Ida Gudjonsson's dad. He was on as a sub. He took the last penalty, and it was a poor penalty by anybody's standards, and it was a relatively straightforward, comfortable save. And but the importance of the save is what people remember, not the quality of the save that I had to make or the quality of the penalty that was taken. It was, you know, one Tottenham, a UEFA Cup, which was, you know, it was a real difficult trophy to win at the time because it wasn't like the Europa League is now where your big boys get dropped out. The champions of your country went into Champions League, what is now Champions League, and the next four or five played in. So you were playing the top teams of the day in their league, and you know, it was a trophy that was difficult to win.
It's great watching those penalties back. I did it before the interview, and two things I noticed. The first one, the first penalty you saved, you got up and there was almost a thrust of your neck, and then you just kind of instinctively just ran. It looked like you just started running,
yeah,
because the momentum carried
you forward. Yeah, I think the penalty, the first penalty was really interesting, because the first penalty I thought was a pretty decent save, low to my left. And when I got up, I was like, okay, I'll save the penalty. And then we scored, and then every time I went in, I was still thinking about the save of the first penalty. So I just kept diving to my left, because I never refocused on the second, third or fourth penalty. By the time the fifth penalty came, I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. I might as well go the other way. So I never even looked at him. I just dived the other way, and it was a poor penalty and a good save, and then up. And I was gone. I was like heading down the high road at Tottenham about 90 miles an hour.
It looked like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it looked like Ray Clements was actually the first one to greet
you. He clotheslined me, like WWF clothesline around my throat. And yeah, he was the first one. And that's what, you know, then when I look back on them things now, people forget that. Ray Clements was fit and ready to play, and the manager stuck with a 21-year-old goalkeeper. Mm. I think that's kind of, you know, and that for me, them things stand out in my mind. I kept England's international goalkeeper out of the team for a large part of that season. And, you know, it was, it was a great night.
Of course, it's not the only trophy you won in your career, because of all the clubs that you played for, Falkirk was where you played most games, yeah, right? And won the B&Q Cup.
Yeah, we won the First Division title. So I got championship medals from First Division up in Scotland. Won the B&Q Cup, which is kind of like, I don't know,
like a checker trade now?
Yeah,
in England?
Probably. Yeah, we beat Motherwell in the final. And I had a spell there 3.5 years where I played a lot of football. I was really enjoyed it. I got voted the best goalkeeper in their 100-year history. And at the turn of their 100-year celebrations, and that was a big honour. So I had a good spell there. I liked Scotland. I liked playing up there. I liked the people. Like I say, it was a good time for me playing wise.
People often talk about the differences between Scottish and English football, the difference in quality. Did you notice that while you were playing?
There is a difference in quality. I tell you what, there isn't a difference in what you have to do as a goalkeeper.
Really?
So if I'm playing, I looked out my daughter's bedroom window yesterday at the end of the garden. On the back there's some fields and there were some men playing football, and I was looking at this old guy, bald head, this looked about 60, playing in goal. He has to do the same things that Cazeniga has to do for Tottenham today. Mm-hmm. He has to make saves, he has to make decisions, he has to come for crosses. If he's coming, is he going to catch, is he going to punch? He has to kick it well, he has to pass it well. So them things don't change wherever you play. So yeah, there was a quality difference. Although at the time I was playing in Scotland, the likes of Rangers had the Gascoignes of this world, and they had the influx of English British players that were kind of lighting up the scene up in Scotland, really, if you like. Aberdeen had a good side, and it was probably a stronger league then than it might. I think it's getting back to somewhere near where it should be in Scotland. I always kind of like watching Scottish teams and how it's going and things like that, but you know, every team in England at one point had 2-3 Scotsmen in it. You wouldn't see a top English team without a top Scottish player in it, at least one of them. And you know, I think the last few years they're producing some good youngsters again.
Now I've got one last question, Rich, you might have another one after me, but it's a bit of an odd one. Whenever you watch highlights back from the 80s games on an old Match of the Day or Big Match or whatever it was, one thing that always strikes me is toilet roll. And the amount of toilet roll that used to come on the pitch and completely saturate the goal nets. Did it ever make any difference? Did you notice it? Did it affect you, or was it just the norm?
I think two games stick out in my mind. My debut away at Upton Park, Tuesday night, under lights, West Ham had a really good team. And the North Bank was right close to the back of the net. And there was this little kid with his mum and dad that just kept throwing marshmallows at me all night and calling me a Jewish so-and-so. Obviously, the reasons behind what they do with Tottenham. And that bugged me. And I kept thinking these marshmallows are doing my head in. And like, don't stand on them, because if you stand on them, they get stuck in your studs, you might slip. So that was one that stuck in my mind. And the only other one that really affected me was the semi-final away in Hajduk Split. We played in the Olympic Stadium, and they used to fire the rockets onto the pitch, And we went one up, and we were controlling the game. I think Mark Falco scored, and it was piddling down a rain, and the pitch was waterlogged, and then they scored one, and they won the game 2-1 at their place. And their second goal, it was just, I remember, like, the rocket landing there and then exploding, and it really affects your concentration, because you think, if that hits me, it's going to could cause a problem. And so they were probably the only two games that did. But you're right, yeah, when you remember watching games and playing in games, and you'd see like something just dribble past you. What's the toilet roll? Just pick it up, throw it away.
Yeah.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. My last question would be, we get a lot of young goalkeepers listening to this, obviously a lot of goalkeeper coaches. More so for the young goalkeepers listening to this, and it'll be the classic question they'll ask, like, how can I maximise my game? How can I get to the pros? Obviously now football's changed, and goalkeeping in particular, you know, more often than not, height seems to be more and more important for a lot of the top clubs, certainly, and the biomechanics of a goalkeeper. So you don't want to necessarily put a young goalkeeper off by saying you won't make it. But talking to young goalkeepers, A, what do you think is important for them to maximise what they've got? And for those that are looking to make it to the pros, is there anything that you think they should be careful of? Anything that might stop them getting to where they want to go?
I think what stops you from getting to where you want to go is yourself. Mm. I think you have to have belief in your own ability. I'm a little bit kind of, obviously I am, because I wasn't the tallest goalkeeper in the world, and I thought I played in an era when it was Land of the Giants. Mm. I think the game in general has got smaller. I think centre-forwards have got smaller. I think centre-halves have got smaller. Koscielny's, Otamendi's of this world. The likes, and that's what I like about people like Guardiola that are bringing to the game. If you're good enough, you'll play. It's not about how tall you are. Still a little bit like that in goal on a Monday morning. I saw a really good goalkeeper. What's he good at? Well, he was 6'6", and he made a great save. And, well, yeah, don't tell me he's a goalie. So I think your athleticism, I think your ability to recover from mistakes, and not be afraid to make mistakes. It's a horrible word. There isn't a better one for it, but you will make mistakes. If you keep making the same mistake, you have a problem. If you make a mistake and you learn from it and you move on, and the next time you see that situation. So you've got to keep putting yourself in the way of making errors to become a better goalie, for sure. So I just think it's, with goalies, if there's a single-mindedness to it. The likes of De Gea took untold grief when he came to Man United, one of the biggest clubs in the world, and he wasn't good enough, and he wasn't this, and he wasn't that, and he wasn't Peter Schmeichel, and he wasn't... Now look at him. Mm. He persevered. He had a strength, a mentality. I think on Lloris's debut in a Europa League game, he came rushing out of his goal, one of his strengths, completely miscued it. Opposition scored. He came in after the game, and I said, is everything okay? And he went, why? You have a problem? I don't have a problem. Me neither. Yeah. I think that says everything about the top boys.
Yeah.
The top boys are the top boys because between their ears, they are stronger. The level of quality amongst goalies is kind of not great. There isn't a lot to choose between how good a save they are. They're good at crosses, and it's what's between their ears and how strong they are. So if you can work on your mental capacity, I think you've got every chance.
Tony Parks, thanks for joining us.
Brilliant. Good stuff.
Well, I don't know about you, but I for one never thought I'd hear of a top-flight goalkeeper being pelted with marshmallows during a game. Have you ever seen anything like it? Or do you simply have a goalkeeping story you'd like to share? Drop us a line on Twitter at GK Union. On Instagram, it's at GK Union Official, or search GK Union on Facebook. You can also drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. That's it for another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast from myself and the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee. Thank you for listening.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio.
Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.